listening to the Survival in Motion podcast. Learn, adapt, prepare, survive.
All right, Angry American, thanks for joining us.
Thanks for having me, brother.
Welcome to the Survival in Motion podcast. I know this is a question you've gotten probably many times before, but just wanted to ask you how you got started writing.
Totally by accident, man.
How old were you?
This was in 2011 is when I started. Well, that's when I started this book series. Now, I've always done a little bit of creative writing stuff, but a lot of it was frustrating and with people stealing work, which sounds hard to believe, but even back then it happened. And so I didn't write for a long time, and I just recently, in 2011, started writing Going Home on a forum just for my own entertainment, just for my own fun. And it took on a life of its own, and here we are, you know, a few years later.
Was that your forum or somebody else's?
No, it was somebody else's. It was a survival website, and I had the most viewed threads on the forum, and I was getting ready to self-publish at the behest of all the people there, and I was trying to communicate with the owner of the board to sell me some ad space, and the guy just wouldn't even answer my messages. It just kind of made me mad. I'd brought a lot of traffic to his website, and I was a very, very active member there. And when the guy just wouldn't even take the time to tell me yes or no, I was willing to pay for the ad space even. I just thought it was cool. I mean, this thing happened on his website. I thought it would be cool to run ads, you know. And when he didn't, I got mad and left. I just moved on. And I've got my own sites now and stuff. And, of course, social media today is the real powerhouse. So that's where I do a lot of stuff. So,
did you write anything when you were a little kid or anything?
I wrote in high school and stuff, like everybody does. I did quite a bit of creative writing there. And my English teacher from my senior year in high school, she really liked it. And the last I spoke to her, she was still using examples of stuff I wrote as examples in the classroom. So I thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah. Was that like post-apocalyptic stuff or?
No, it was all kinds of crazy stuff back then. The one she actually hangs on to was a parody thing we wrote in class about Beowulf. So I can kind of write about a little anything, really, if I put my mind to it.
Wow. Okay. Yeah. Beowulf is pretty dry, as I recall.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, no, the story's pretty exciting, you know, for a myth and thing, as in Grendel and all that. It was pretty cool. I actually got into it.
That's cool. And you're in a prep group along with the other author I've talked with recently, Walt Browning.
Yeah. Me and Walt are friends, and we're in a group together. We train together and stuff. Me and him talk at least once a week, if not more. We get out and do things. We have a group camp out coming up here next month, as a matter of fact, where it's going to be pretty much an overnighter out of your ruck, you know, just to get everybody out there, get them used to living out of their pack, and a good chance for them to test the gear they carry and see what they're missing, see what they don't need, see what breaks or doesn't fill the need that they think they've packed it for. So it's always good to do stuff like that. We just waited till the weather cooled off a little bit because it's just pure misery down here in Florida.
And you guys recently had a hurricane, I think, right?
Yeah, one blew through the panhandle up there. Thankfully, it didn't hurt us. You know, we had the hurricane last year that knocked power out at my house here for about a week. So, you know, we stay ready for them.
So do you go on camping trips that much with this prepper group of yours?
We do at least one a year, the group does. You know, I spend a little more time in the woods than they do just because of what I do, you know. One of my producers with the TV show, he's going to be coming down, and he and I are going to go spend 3 or 4 days basically doing just that. You know, he wants to bring his gear down and test it. And so I've got a secured place where we can go where it's not public, it's private land, so we can be armed and we can do different stuff and get him some dirt time because he needs it. You know, we all need more dirt time.
Well, yeah, that's for sure. What TV show is this?
My TV show. We're converting the books into a TV series.
Oh, when did that happen? I didn't hear anything about that.
Yeah, it's an ongoing process. It's taking time, but I've formed a production company. I now have two producers. One of the guys is in New York. The other one was in L.A. and actually just moved back to Florida. So the guy in New York, his name's Mark Humphreys, and the guy from L.A., his name's Scott Levy. Scott's got quite a bit of time in L.A., about 22 years working in Hollywood. And Mark's fairly new to the movie-making business, but he's done some documentaries and stuff, and he's wrapping up his degree right now at the New York Film Academy. And so he's getting a seriously good education up there, and we're going to put all that to use.
What time frame do you think this will be on TV or in the theaters?
That depends. You know, We're wrapping up the script right now. I've had a script that I've been working on for about a year, and with Scott and Mark's input, we're getting it fine-tuned down to something really, really good. I had a conference call with a lawyer yesterday. We're getting our legal representation online before we do anything else, because in this business, everybody's out to get you. So I hired a pretty high-caliber lawyer. He comes with a high-caliber price tag, but it's all about not getting cheated, you know, because in this business, it's really, really bad. And there's a number of things you have to do. Everybody thinks you just write this script and somebody reads it and they want it. There's way more to it than that. You've got to have a script. You've got to have a thing called the show Bible, which is all kinds of stuff, even like cartoon strips of the show, stuff like that, so that people can get an idea of what it's going to look like. We've got graphics people right now, like cartoonists designing the characters, actually drawing them and stuff, for what they kind of look like, stuff like that. So we're getting all the foundation laid to potentially pitch it that way. And if we don't get traction there, then we're actually going to shoot the pilot ourselves. And that'll be a whole nother animal, because the budget for the pilot's about $3 million. And that's all money I'll have to raise through investors and donations and all that stuff. But I don't think it'll be a problem with some of the phone calls I've had here the last couple of weeks. So.
Cool. And that's going to be based on your Going Home series?
Yeah, the pilot will be based on Going Home, and it covers about the first three chapters, plus some additional stuff that was never in the books that people always wondered what was happening here or there, or what were these folks doing. And in the pilot, we introduce all that. I think the pilot, with the way we have the script right now, the pilot's going to be awesome. We always hear that when a book gets converted to a TV show or a movie, that they messed it up and it was never the same. I'm hoping that when people see the pilot, or see the show that we're putting together, they might actually say that the show was better than the books, just because of the flow of the way we're doing things.
Well, that's cool. Well, I hope it works out for you. Regarding your books, you're what's known as a hybrid author, right? Because you've had some of your books published by publishing houses, I think Penguin, right?
Right, correct.
And then a lot of them are self-published.
Well, it's like half and half right now, really. The series is five books with Penguin, five books I self-published, plus the collaborative works I've done with everybody else. Those are all self-published, so I guess it's weighted a little heavier to the self-published side.
You wrote a couple with Walt Browning, right?
Yeah, Walt Browning. I did one with Jeff Hopp. Then I also did a separate book myself called Cry Havoc, a novella and some other stuff. But yeah, I've done both, and it's kind of funny. You know, in the literary world, you're not considered published unless you're traditionally published by one of the big print houses, which is kind of silly to me. I think that's goofy. And the publishing industry perpetuates that stigma to reinforce their own position, because they're like newspapers. They're a dying breed. You know, they don't have nearly the reach or the clout they used to have. But they're still important. They're still very important. So,
yeah, I understand as far as the I don't need to get into the details of it, but the cut that the author gets is a whole lot better with self-published.
Oh, substantially, yeah. But see, you have to weigh it now. With Penguin, my books were in every bookstore. They were at the airport. They were in Walmart. They were available everywhere. They were available on Apple, Barnes & Noble, Kobo. They were available everywhere. When I self-publish, I weigh pretty heavy to Amazon, and then I move things later to Barnes & Noble, which I need to get a couple of them up at Barnes & Noble right now. But I don't have the bookstores. I don't have Apple per se, because they're such a pain to deal with. So you make more per book, but I probably sell less books. But it's kind of a wash, really.
Oh, okay. Kind of a trade-off.
Mm-hmm.
In your books, where do you get the ideas for your characters?
Well, they're amalgamations of people I've known over the years, from folks I've worked with and just known. You know, like Sarge in the books, he's based off Gunny, Arlie Ermey. I've met him and got to talk with him before. He was a great guy, and I dearly miss that he's gone. That's a shame, because, you know, I think of him every time I'm working on the books. What people tell me is when they read these books, everybody's like, I know somebody just like that. And I think we all know people like these people, because each character is based off of several different people, just kind of blending their personalities and their mannerisms a little bit and coming up with some interesting folks.
It might be inevitable that the protagonist might be a little autobiographical.
Oh, well, yeah. When I started writing Going Home, I literally had just come home that day from Thomasville, Georgia, driving the route that Morgan walked. I traveled a lot for work back then and was always driving to South Georgia. And I had just got back from there that day and wrote that story kind of as a what if, what would I do? You know, how would I handle this sort of situation? So, of course, you know, you're basing a little bit on yourself.
Yeah, or wannabe. In my case, one of my protagonists is a real tall, good-looking guy. It'd be nice to be like that.
Well, that's why Morgan was an average dude who was overweight. And he's a little closer to home, you know?
Yeah, I hear you. How about plots or genres? I mean, this whole Going Home series is post-apocalyptic, but do you get any other ideas from work or family or the news?
Well, this is my work. This is all I do now. So, but yeah, I study a lot of international, not politics, but goings on, you know, things that are happening around the world. I follow a lot of events very closely. And yeah, I've got a zillion ideas for books, not all of them necessarily post-apocalyptic. I've got an idea right now for one that I might do with some SF guys, like a military thriller sort of thing, kind of a very realistic look at it as opposed to some of the stuff that's put out by folks who have never served or been exposed to the military guys, and they write books about them and they don't come off right.
That's usually what I've noticed. And I think I talked to Walt Browning about this. I don't think he ever served, but his books sound like he has.
Well, that's because Walt's smart and he utilizes folks that do those things. Like there's a scene in the new one coming up about submarines, and we got a hold of some submariners and talk to them to get the parts right, to get the stuff right. There's no better equal than experience. And if you can't have the experience, you find somebody else who's had it, who knows what they're doing, has been there and done that and got the T-shirt, and you get them to tell you the way it's done. So, you know, I hate to miss the mark on stuff like that. I'm pretty detailed in my research and stuff to make sure that it comes off right, that it's not too grandiose or over the top. You know, in my books, the good guys don't always win. They suffer losses too, as you will in the real world.
Yeah. You know? Well, it's that challenge of you got to keep, whether it's the science or just some kind of factoid, you got to keep it right so the reader will feel safe in letting down their guard and believing what you're writing about, you know?
Yeah, I mean, I've never thought of it that way. I've always looked at it as I don't want to pass on bad information. I don't care if it's how to process kudzu or how a Carl Gustav Rokola's rifle works. I want it all right and accurate, and I want the information to be correct. And hopefully the readers will believe it because I don't make stuff up. You know, truth is always stranger than fiction, and so the more real you can make things, in my opinion, the better off they are, the better they come out.
Yep. Well, it's occurred to me that as an author – while I'm writing a book, it seems like there's a whole lot of different research projects that I do along the way just to make a certain chapter technically correct. Recently, I was doing some research on nuclear bombs and how the small ones work. And it's not only a challenge to get it right, but also how to find out these facts online without winding up on some government list somewhere, you know?
Yeah, I've been researching for the last year to find out exactly how ISIS made their hell cannons. And I've yet to come across anything that can really definitively explain to me how they built those. I mean, looking at them, I know how they built them. But I was looking for a little more details on some stuff for a project I want to do. But like you said, you got to be careful. You know, there's some websites you wander into and you are immediately on a list. And if they put me on a list and then started looking around at the other stuff that I'm looking up and Googling and whatnot, it would probably not end real well, or at least end with a visit from some alphabet soup guys.
Exactly. Yeah, after my first EMP book, I remember I took a business trip and I got through security and I thought, wow, that's kind of an accomplishment. I mean, I thought I'd be on a no-fly list or something.
Well, you know, it's kind of funny when you print your boarding pass at the house and you see the security thing across the top of it, so you know your bag's going to be searched. Every single time I fly, if I check a bag, it's got a TSA love note in it when I get to the other end. On both sides. It happens both ways. So, yeah.
Where do you get your ideas for antagonists and the bad guys in your books?
Well, you know, I want them to be just as believable as the protagonists and his allies. So I base those off of kind of real people. And in some cases, I also will just step into the shoes of the bad guy and be like, what would I do here? And how would I do this if I was going to do it? You know, everybody wants to stand on the high ground and I would never do this and I would never do that. But, you know, I've got a wife and kids to take care of. And so I've explored those options of how deep a person could go. Like, you know, you've got a wife and two kids and they're starving to death and your neighbor's out back grilling ribs. Are you really just going to look over the fence at him and ask? And when he says no, then what are you going to do? And people underestimate how quickly they will devolve to their base instincts. And we all will. Everybody who says that they will die before they steal or do anything like that. The problem is in this country, we have no real frame of reference for what true hunger is and true desperation is. Just because you didn't get your Christmas bonus, that's not desperation. Not having a place to live in. We see homeless today, but even they're not desperate. Our homeless people are overweight. You know, they're begging on the street corners, and we read all the time how much money some of these folks make. So they're not desperate. We have no frame of reference for desperation here, and people just don't get it.
Yeah, our family was evacuated a couple years ago for a fire, and I think it was 3 days. And I was still eating and everything, but I was amazed at how cranky I got just having to sleep like on a friend's couch. And then at one point we borrowed somebody's RV, and then we were in a hotel. We were completely cranky.
Well, yeah, your normalcy, your routine, your daily pattern's been interrupted. And like you said, that was 3 days. You knew it was going to end. Well, you hoped you'd be able to go home. There was a little uncertainty there probably. But imagine what that would have been like if you would have known you could not go back and that everything you knew prior to that moment no longer existed or existed in an entirely different form than what you'd always know.
Yeah.
It'll change your perspective in a hurry.
Exactly. It occurred to me that I think as a country, we're kind of easing off a bit as far as the urgency for prepping. And I don't need to get political here, although I won't turn it down if you want to talk about it. But
oh, it don't bother me none. We can go there. I don't care.
Okay. I was doing some research for my last podcast on somebody else's podcast, Radio Free Readout.
Oh, yeah.
And I was referring to a couple of episodes that John Jacob Schmidt recorded in October 2016. And, you know, he lists how many times his podcast episodes have been downloaded. And back in 2016, it seemed like they were like 3,000-4,000 downloads per episode. And nowadays, it's down to about 1,500-1,700 per episode. It's all still good quality episodes, but I think that goes to show you that since the 2016 election, I think preppers have kind of let off the gas a little bit as far as the urgency.
Well, that's because everybody's hung up in the left-right dichotomy. So while traditional preppers fell away, there has been a massive surge in millennial preppers, people who we wouldn't think normally as preppers. When Obama took the office, the right panicked and the world was going to end and everybody started prepping and getting ready and stuff. There was 8 years of that, and prepping was a booming business. Trump got elected, and that fell off a cliff for a few minutes until the folks on the left started finding those resources, and then they started utilizing them because as far as they're concerned now, the world is going to end and they need to get ready. So prepping shifted from traditional audience to a very non-traditional audience, and they're prepping, but probably not with the same fervor and mindset that people on the right were. You watch, if a Democrat's elected in 2020, prepping will shoot to the moon again. It'll take off like a rocket. They're just short-sighted. They think just because Trump won, you know, we're all safe now and everything's hunky-dory. And that's just not the case. The same threat still exists, more so really now. You know, you look at the violence that the left is perpetuating, and, you know, now we have this hoax bombing thing. And I say hoax because having examined pictures of one of those things, I say they're hoax bombs. They're not real ones. I mean, red and black wire, one wire going into each end of the pipe. That's not how you wire a detonator. And if you're any damn good, your timers and stuff would have been inside the bomb where it would have been really difficult to get to, not taped to the outside of it. But that's beside the point. It's just the fact that the rhetoric, the soft violence at the moment is building. And eventually things will go kinetic at some point, someplace, and then it's going to be all bets are off at that point.
I also did some more research on all the rioting that's going on in the cities out there, you know, by Antifa and Portland. And kind of think of it, that's a lot of millennials there. It looked to me, I mean, half of them were wearing masks, you know.
Yeah, and that's because they don't want to show their faces because they know what they're doing is criminal. I mean, you walk up and bash somebody in the head from behind, you know, you don't even offer a fair fight, which there's no such thing as a fair fight. I shouldn't even have said that. If I'm in a fair fight, I'm losing already. So,
but same here.
They hide behind each other. But everybody underestimates the left. Everybody's like, so many folks I talk to are like, well, I can't wait. It'll be blood in the streets. It'll be open season on Antifa. And there's a guy that writes a blog called Mountain Gorilla. And he writes an excellent blog. More folks should read it. But it's like he says, these guys are already committing acts of violence. They're already willing to stand in the street and take beanbag rounds to the junk for the chance to throw a brick at a cop. They have a logistics arm behind them. They're highly organized. They can mass in short order anywhere that they want to mass. And what are the folks on the right doing? We're sitting at home bitching about them, cleaning guns, talking about how easy it's going to be to kill them all. Yeah, the John Brown Gun Club's a joke, and the rest of them, they're jokes, the videos they put out. But not all of those guys are jokes. You know, you look at Bill Ayers and the work that the Weather Underground did, it's real, you know. And at some point, some of their folks are going to decide that today's the day, and I'm not looking forward to the 20th of next month, you know, when the midterms will be decided, and we'll have to see which direction things go at that point.
Yeah. The riots I've been watching on YouTube, so many of them are right there in the downtown area, and there are so many businesses still going on right around them. You know, it's like if there's a lull in the riot, you know, some of the rioters can pop into Nordstrom Rack and pick up a few bargains, you know, and then go back out and join the riot.
That's because those cities cater to those people. They know that they're on their turf. And guys like the Proud Boys and all them going out to meet them to – Antifa wouldn't have the platform it has if nobody engaged with them. Don't go and engage them. There'll be a bunch of idiots standing around the street in masks, talking and shouting and waving their hammer and sickle flags, and everybody will look at them like the retards they are. You know, these are all people that are too young to have any base information about communism, what it really is, and socialism. You know, it's funny when someone like Antifa, who claims to champion gay and lesbian rights, wears Che Guevara shirts, when Che Guevara would have executed any gay or lesbian he came across.
Oh, with pleasure. Yeah.
See, they just don't understand the stuff that they're even defending or perpetuating. It's just pure ignorance is what it is. And they're encouraged along by the democratic machine because they're useful idiots. They're cannon fodder. So they don't care what happens to those people.
Yeah, it's crazy. I think a lot of that has to do with what's being taught in schools nowadays, that socialism is just okay and Marxism is fine, and it's crazy what they're being taught nowadays.
Well, you know, they're slowly rewriting history. And is our system perfect? No, mainly because it's not what it was intended to be. The federal government shouldn't be bailing out banks and stuff. Wall Street shouldn't come before the rest of us. I agree with that entirely. But that doesn't mean I'm going to go set Wall Street on fire or I'm going to assault bankers or whatever. I think a lot of them, if we were doing things the way we're supposed to, most of those bastards would be in prison, which is where they belong. So.
Well, it looks like they're trying to get there. Hey, can I ask you, do you have a CHL? And if so, what are you packing and what do you got at home?
Oh, yeah, I got a permit. I'm always carrying. It depends on the day, you know, what mood I'm in. It might be a, you know, Glock 19, or it could be a Kimber Ultra Carry 1911, or it could be a Glock 17 with an RMR, or it could be Springfield XD, or it could be a number of things. It just depends on what I feel like toting that day. Might even be a Colt Mustang 380. You know, it just depends on what I'm into that day. So. And where I'm going, too. Big part of where I'm going.
Yeah, I like Glocks, definitely.
I like Glocks, but I'm not a Glock fanboy. I'm not a fanboy of any particular brand, actually. I've got Glock, Sig, Springfield, Colt, Kimber. I can't even remember the rest of them. There's more in there, too, though. And, you know, the firearm argument to me always makes me laugh because it's a lot like the truck argument. Ford, Dodge, Chevy, you know, GMC. They all make good products. You just got to find the one that you like, the one that works for you. So I drive Ford trucks because I like those, and I have a whole bunch of different manufacturers of guns. So
yeah, I hear you. Aside from my books and your books, do you have any favorite post-apocalyptic books?
My all-time favorite, hands down, is The Last Babylon. That's my all-time favorite.
That was like in the 50s, right?
Yeah, it was in the 50s, set in Orlando. They actually used the town of Mount Dora as the reference for Fort Repose, and Mount Dora's 15 minutes up the road from me, which always makes me laugh because Fort Repose is on the St. John's River, and Mount Dora is nowhere even remotely close to St. John's River, but that's what they call literary license. So, yeah, that's my all-time favorite. And I try not to read or listen to too many of the newer post-apocalyptic books, if you want to call them that, survival books, whatever, because I don't want to be influenced by other writers. So,
yeah, exactly. Same here.
So most of the time I'm I don't never read. I don't have time because if I'm sitting there reading a book, I should be sitting there writing a book. But when I'm in the truck, I'm always playing audiobooks. And so it generally tends to be like some science fiction stuff or books on physics. I like to listen to that stuff, spaceships and aliens and that kind of thing.
How about movies, post-apocalyptic movies? Do you have any favorites?
They've never made a good one. I mean, The End or How It Ends just came out. That was awful. I haven't seen a really good, in my opinion, post-apocalyptic movie.
Okay.
I just don't have one that I could say, yeah, that one works for me.
Yeah. How about YouTube channels?
Well, I watch a lot of Such. He's one of the guys, Mike the Cop, some guys I listen to on podcasts. I watch a lot of RNU videos online, which is a Russian YouTube channel. And I watch a number of survival guys, too, both in the U.S. and abroad. Some guys in Australia and U.K., Canada, a lot of Canadians. Seeing what they're up to, watching what they do.
Okay, what are your future plans? You mentioned the TV show or movie. What else is going on?
Well, it's going to be a TV show for sure. That's the number one mover at the moment. Plus more books, I'm working on a sequel to my book, Cry Havoc, and as well, I've got another one called Western Resolve, which is a spinoff from Going Home series that takes place in Wyoming. But my buddy that I'm writing that with, who actually lives in Wyoming, the rancher, he's moving his ranch, so we're kind of slowed down on that one right now. But that'll let me focus back on book 11 and the sequel to Cry Havoc.
I forgot to ask where you got the name Angry American spelled as it is.
Yeah, a lot of people, it's funny because people put on Facebook, how can you be an author and you can't spell angry? And there's actually a definition for that in the Urban Dictionary. And it's like to be angry over something trivial or nonsensical. And when I was writing on the forum where I wrote the books, it was my username because Obama had just come into office when I started writing that stuff or when I joined that forum. At the time, the government, him in particular, didn't really care about us, the clingers, the deplorables. And so I just made that my username. And when people urged me to publish the book, no one knew my name. So I had to go with the username because that's how everybody knew the books. If I'd have published under my name, no one would have been able to find them. But by going with the Angry American thing, I mean, they had 2 million views online. People will find that. So
the book itself says A American, right?
Well, that's because Penguin came along and they said, there's no way in hell we're putting that on the front of the book. You need to come up with something else. They're like, put your name on it. I said, how about A American? And they're like, all right, we'll do that. I said, cool. All right, we'll go that route then.
Well, if ever there's an alphabetical list, you'll be at the top of it. That's for sure.
Yeah, I'll be pretty close to the top. Yeah.
I poked into the Facebook group Angry American Asylum, and
yeah,
that's pretty active there.
Yeah, that's the fan page that a guy started. He asked if he could start it. I'm like, I don't care. Go for it. And so No, that's not even me. I didn't even start it. He asked if he could build it, and I said, build it. And so I pop in there and say stuff every now and then. But, I've got 1, 2, 3, 4 Facebook pages. I'm fixing to add another one for the TV show, plus Instagram, plus, all the other social media stuff I do. And it's just hard to get into all of them on a daily basis.
Is there any one place where your readers can keep up to date with you?
Facebook's a good one, but then there's also angryamerican.tv, and that has a blog on it, which I've got blog articles open right now on the computer I'm sitting behind that will be going up on there pretty quick, as well as I send out a newsletter. And there's a store there, so if people want to order signed books and that kind of thing, hats or patches or shirts, they can go on there and order all that stuff. It's a pretty solid operation because there's even customer support. If there's a problem, you call in, you can talk to a person, we'll get your problems fixed for you. So it's pretty nice.
Cool. Well, I appreciate you joining me here at the Survival in Motion podcast, and all the best to you. Thanks for joining me.
It's been awesome, man. Thanks for having me.